Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. The Oregon Legislature ended its 2019 regular session on June 30th. Today on Prison Pipeline, we're going to take a look back at the session and see how well criminal justice reform did. Earlier today, I spoke with Alice Lundell, Director of Communications for the Oregon Justice Resource Center. Tell me about some of the significant victories that you had this year. And if you want to start with SB 1008, that would be great.
Well, yeah, so this has been a very big year for criminal justice reform in Oregon. I think people would say this has been one of the most successful legislative sessions for criminal justice reform in a long time. Really, we've seen some big decisions by legislators. Some of that has maybe been overshadowed recently by all of the difficulties that they've had getting people to show up. But you know, we shouldn't take away from the fact that this has been a real time of progress. The biggest thing, I guess, for most people, is the bill that you mentioned, Senate Bill 1008. So broadly speaking, this is a bill to reform sentencing of young people, so people under 18, for serious or violent crimes. So it does a number of things. It basically started out as multiple bills, and they all got combined into one because they all have this theme of recognizing that young people are different, that what we know about the science of youth brain development means that adolescents and young adults under about 25 are actually different in the way that their brains work from children or from mature adults, and we need to recognize that in our criminal justice system. The tendency has been, especially when we think back to the 1990s and the era when people were talking about super predators, there was a lot of concern about youth violent crime particularly. And we saw across the country in the late 80s and into the 90s, and here in Oregon, we saw measures passed which were designed to be harsher, be more punitive to young people committing crimes. So here in Oregon, we adopted Measure 11 that was passed by the voters in 94 and became law in 95. And Measure 11 has had a tremendous effect on our justice system and on young people particularly in terms of the length of sentences, the fact that these sentences are a mandatory minimum, so there is no getting out early, you know, there is no earning good time. The sentence you get is the sentence that you're going to serve. And under Measure 11, young people who are as young as 15 can be prosecuted as though they were adults and be subject to all of the penalties if they get convicted that an adult would get. But even before conviction, just being prosecuted under Measure 11 takes away some of the protections that we usually give to youth, like anonymity. So your name can be made public, your photograph can be made public. So even if you don't end up with a Measure 11 conviction, if you end up with a lesser conviction potentially, you know, your identity is still out there. And when people are searching your name online, perhaps for a job application or when you're trying to find housing, that is going to follow you long term, even if you never get the Measure 11 conviction. So Senate Bill 1008 did multiple things. Two of the biggest things it did, though, were take youth out of this automatic waiver into adult court under Measure 11. So now young people will get a hearing to decide if they should be waived into adult court, but kind of the default position is they shouldn't. They should be treated as youth because we recognize that they are different. Another thing that it did, which is big, was ending juvenile life without parole. So Oregon is no longer going to sentence people under 18 to a lifetime in prison with no possibility of getting out. Again, because we recognize that youth have a huge capacity to change and grow. And even people who commit very, very serious crimes as youth really do have the potential to mature, to grow, and to eventually learn to be different than they were when they committed these crimes. And not everyone is going to get to that point. Not everyone will ever be released. But in line with what the U.S. Supreme Court has decided and in line with what is happening elsewhere, we're recognizing that that potential is there. And courts should recognize that by leaving open the possibility that one day that person will be in a place to leave prison. It doesn't guarantee they'll get out. It just gives the possibility is there, and the system should recognize that that should be available as an option, maybe, one day for those people. Some of the other things that have happened, apart from Senate Bill 1008, just this weekend, it's kind of, you know, snuck through at the last minute, Senate Bill 1013. This is a bill to narrow the application of the death penalty. So Oregon currently has a very long list of aggravating factors that can kind of upgrade the severity of a murder and make it eligible for the death penalty as one of the sentencing options. This bill narrows those factors, and it also removes one of the questions that jurors used to have to answer when sentencing, which was asking them to predict whether that person would be dangerous in future. Now, everything we know from the experts is that even they can't predict reliably whether somebody will be dangerous in future simply based on their past behavior. So to try to make that a condition of sentencing to death does not make a lot of sense. So that bill has passed, which means that there will be fewer circumstances in which somebody would be eligible for the death penalty, and therefore the likely effect is that we will see fewer death sentences in Oregon. How much it suppresses the number of new death sentences is hard to say at this point. We also don't know how DAs will react to it, but we should see fewer cases where the death penalty is an option for sentencing, and fewer that actually result in death sentences. A couple of other things that I'll mention. We as an organization, the Oregon Justice Resource Center, work with incarcerated women, providing civil legal services to help them address things like if they have an eviction on their record, if they have child support outstanding, these kinds of issues that can build up while you're in prison. You can accumulate a lot of debt, you can accumulate court judgments against you or things on your rental history that when you get out, in the middle of trying to find a job, find somewhere to live, pick up the threads of your life from before prison, you then have all these other kind of financial or civil issues following you. So we got some funding through the legislature to help expand these services to women at Coffee Creek Prison as a pilot program to try to help women resolve these issues while they're in the relative stability of incarceration versus once they're out and it's kind of harder to address those problems. So it's trying to deal with a problem before it kind of snowballs over the time that they're in prison. It's a pilot program funded for a couple of years. Will it, you know, end up expanding to other prisons through the whole prison system in Oregon? We don't know yet. We've just kind of soon going to be starting work on that. But we're really hopeful that this is going to show some really good outcomes as far as helping women address these needs, which is good for all of us because we're all better off as a community if people who have been in prison come out in a position where they are well set up to reintegrate into the community, to find a way of living that is, you know, pro-social, peaceful, non-violent, non-criminal. And so setting people up to do that well is good for public safety, and it's good for public finances because it's really expensive when people keep going through the justice system and keep going back into incarceration. Final thing that I'll mention is there were some reforms around the criminal justice system which were designed to protect the rights of immigrants. A couple of bills, one which says that if you're a defendant in a criminal case, you don't have to tell the court your immigration status unless there's actual legal relevance to it. So the reason for that is that when courts ask people to disclose their immigration status and people disclose that they are immigrants, that has a likelihood of risking greater prejudice on the part of the court or on the part of jurors against that person, even though that, you know, their being an immigrant is not relevant to their guilt or innocence or to the severity of what they may have done. But it can, you know, increase prejudice, and it can also put people at risk of immigration enforcement, even if, you know, potentially they have done something on the very low end of the scale, or where they may not even be guilty. Just because they're in court doesn't mean they're actually guilty of the crime. Another bill which also related to immigration was around diversion programs. So there are programs where, particularly if you're a first-time offender, if you're a more low-level offender, around things like drugs, for example, you can go into a diversion program where, as an alternative to formal punishment, you go into one of these programs to help you deal with your addiction problem or your behavior problem. And it's all, really all about, you know, trying to find ways to address the root causes of these issues rather than simply going straight to a punishment model when somebody is kind of first coming into contact with the system. Now, the way that the diversion program was set up in Oregon, you had to enter a plea, so you had to say you were guilty in order to qualify for the program. Now, Oregon doesn't treat that guilty plea as a criminal conviction because it's part of that diversion program. That's one of the benefits you would get from going through the program successfully. But the immigration system is federal law, and it has tended to treat those guilty pleas as counting as a conviction for immigration purposes. So this tweak to the law allows people in Oregon to go into these diversion programs, but without entering a plea, and thereby ensuring that while they can still do the program, they can still go for rehabilitation, and we can all benefit from people getting rehabilitated. At the same time, they're not going to fall foul of immigration law simply because the immigration law interprets the Oregon guilty plea to mean a conviction, even though Oregon doesn't consider that to be a conviction. So that's just a selection of some of the bigger bills that happened around criminal justice reform. But, you know, there's been a lot of attention on criminal justice reform this session. So there's actually, you know, really a lot of big things that we could talk about.
Very big year indeed. Wow. This is, of course, I'm speaking with Alice Lindell, Director of Communication at the Oregon Justice Resource Center. And what kind of reforms will you and of course, I know you Oregon Justice Resource Center works in coalition with a number of organizations around the state working on justice reforms and do tremendous work. So what kind of reforms are we be working to get the legislature to focus on over the next couple of years?
Well, I think it's early for us to sort of say definitively what we think we're going to work on by the next session in 2 years. So we have to look back on what's happened this time and consider. But two issues that I think the Oregon Justice Resource Center, we feel like are going to be important. One is to look at the issue of intimate partner violence, or what we might say domestic abuse, and the relevance of that within criminal cases. So there is, you know, kind of starting to be more recognition or more discussion of the fact that people who have been, who are in a relationship where intimate partner violence is a factor, and who then also are involved in criminal behavior, that there is connection there, and there is influence from being somebody who is a victim of intimate partner violence, and how that affects your thinking, how that affects your behavior. You can be coerced into crime, either through explicit threats or simply through the way in which you are being kind of mentally worn down and controlled through this abusive relationship. And we have to find ways for our criminal justice system to take better account of what are, frankly, a a shocking number of women in our justice system, and also a number of men, but particularly a large number of women in our justice system who have an involvement in crime, but also there is a factor there of this abusive relationship. And how are we going to address the fact that on the one hand, people are responsible for their actions, but on the other hand, we know so much now about how abuse affects people's behavior, affects people's thinking, affects people emotionally, psychologically. And at the moment, we're not doing a great job of addressing the interaction of that, of those two issues. What you have done in terms of the crime you committed, but the fact that you have made decisions within a context of a total lack of, you know, freedom of choice or freedom of seeing other options there because you were so much being controlled and subjected to threats and violence and other factors like within the relationship. So we need to look around that issue, I think. And another issue is kind of what do we do about, with some of these criminal justice reforms that have been made, what do we do about people left behind? Because one of the effects of the justice system, of course, is that when people are serving long sentences and you have decisions like, for example, the decision under Senate Bill 1008 to end juvenile life without parole, well, that, you know, that goes forward, but that's not retroactive. So there are a number of people who are in prison in Oregon who were convicted and sentenced as juveniles to life without parole. And those people have, you know, a long time still to live, a long time still in the prison system. So even though we have now ended that practice, we have, as it stands, decades ahead of us of people still still being affected by what we used to do in terms of things like sentencing young people to spend the rest of their life in prison. So I think there's a broad question there around how does the system address the question of retroactivity. Senate Bill 1008 is not retroactive. It is difficult to make things retroactive because you're asking to go back to unpick all these decisions that have already been made. Are you going to retry people? Are you going to resentence them? You know, it leads to a lot of complication. But on the other hand, if we know better now and we're going to do better, why are we content to leave people behind in the system and not address these cases that are standing out where somebody has had this sentence that we now wouldn't consider acceptable, and we're going to let them spend, you know, many future decades dealing with the consequences of a sentence which no longer would be allowed. So I think there's a broad question there around retroactivity or how to handle the people who are left behind by the changes that are prospective rather than retrospective. To stay up to date with what we're doing, you can visit our website, www.ojrc.org. We have information on there about our programs and also things that we're working on.
You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. We just heard part of my interview with Alice Lundell from the Oregon Justice Resource Center. The Oregon legislature just wrapped up its 2019 regular session, and we're discussing the progress that criminal justice reform made this year. Now, let's hear from Andrew Riley, Communications and Policy Associate at Unite Oregon. The Oregon legislature adjourned on June 30th, ending its session, the regular session for 2019. There were definitely some successes in the area of criminal justice this year and justice reform. What were some of the most significant victories for Unite Oregon?
Yeah, one of the biggest ones for us and for the communities we work with was the passage of Senate Bill 577. We also call that the Larnell Bruce Jr. Hate Crimes Act. It's the first update to Oregon's hate crime laws since 1981. It's a big package of changes that modernize the hate crime statute. One, it makes it possible to charge lone wolf attackers with felony hate crimes. That was previously not possible under Oregon law. It mandates that the state collect and report data on hate crimes and bias incidents so that we know when, where, how, and to whom these attacks are happening. It also creates some resources for victims of bias incidents that, for whatever reason, can't be charged as hate crimes. And it also clarifies that gender identity is a protected class when it comes to hate crimes or bias incidents. So it's a really comprehensive package that's going to really modernize our state hate crimes laws. We're also celebrating the passage of House Bill 2015. It is the known as the Equal Access to Roads Act, which makes sure that every Oregon resident, regardless of their citizenship or documentation status, can get a valid driver's license. You know, driving without a valid license can expose you to severe consequences, up to and including deportation for some immigrants. And so, you know, we really are glad to have folks have the ability to get those licenses. And then another one is more of a technical fix kind of law. It's called House Bill 2401, but it updates our State's End Profiling Act, which Unite Oregon was instrumental in passing, to expand data collection on pedestrian stops. Right now, if you're a pedestrian and an officer stops you, they only have to file a report with their agency if you are given a citation or arrested. But we know that across Oregon, many police departments are updating or conducting what Portland police have called quote-unquote mere conversations, which, you know, can involve a pat-down or other kind of brief search, but weren't being captured in our statewide reporting, even though they can and do lead to profiling. So now we're going to know more about those incidents.
Got it. A pat-down as a simple conversation is just... So now, were there any measures that you were hoping to advance that that fell short this session?
Yeah, there's one big one for us, House Bill 3225. We sometimes call this the Your Right to Know Act, and it's a form of a consent to search law. And so what it would have done is made it so that when a law enforcement officer stops you and wants to conduct a voluntary search, they would have to inform you that that search is voluntary. So it's sort of like the Miranda warning, but for searches and pat-downs. And what we found in our communities is that when an armed, uniformed law enforcement officer stops you, you may not feel comfortable telling them that they can't search you, even if you have the right to refuse that search. So we wanted to pass this policy that would require the officer to inform you of that right and also get your affirmative written consent to search your person. We unfortunately did not even get that bill to a hearing, but it's something that we're going to keep fighting for until we win.
That leads into the next question. What kind of reforms will you be working to get the legislature to focus on over the next couple of years?
Yeah, so consent to search, your right to know, again, is going to be one of our top priorities. We think that that's a really important tool to make sure that folks know their rights. Outside of that, one of the things we're going to be watching over the next few months is the release of data under the End Profiling Act from 2015. And that's going to give us really a sense of where Oregon is in terms of bias-based policing, where profiling is occurring. And so we want to look at that information and identify any opportunities to strengthen state profiling law based on that. And finally, we're also going to be pushing for the state to rethink its funding priorities, specifically when it comes to, on the one hand, police and prisons, and on the other, things like mental health treatment, housing, and health care. At a big picture level, we as an organization do not believe that locking folks up, especially Black, Brown, and Indigenous folks, makes us safer or healthier. But by reinvesting the funds we now spend on law enforcement and corrections into things like social service programs, those really do affirm community health and community safety.
What would you say are some of the biggest challenges that criminal justice reform faces in Oregon?
There's a couple. I think one big challenge we face is the same that a lot of different movements are facing, in that, you know, this work is by and large driven by, you know, informal groups of activists, ourselves as a cash-strapped 501c3 organization. We're working, you know, within what is effectively an unregulated campaign finance system. So unlike the many organizations that come together to support more spending on policing and prisons, we can't afford to cut large checks to legislators' campaigns in the way that, say, police unions or others can. Our opposition is well-organized and well-funded, and that makes it harder for us to find champions who are willing to spend their political capital on these issues in the legislature. And to be clear, there are some folks in the House and the Senate that get it. They fight for our priorities and our communities, but we're still at an advantage in a system that is effectively legalized corruption. And that also has an impact on the public narrative around police and prisons, and the notion out there that, you know, paramilitary law enforcement and incarceration somehow keep us safer, when we know that that's not true. But what you see around the public discourse is, you know, centers around the idea that crime is on the rise, that police are largely understaffed, especially in places like Portland, that we have a shortage of jail beds, and so we should, you know, put more money into these systems. And I don't think our movement has been particularly effective at challenging these ideas head on. And that's resulted in, you know, for example, the broad bipartisan support that passed Measure 11, mandatory minimum sentences. You know, it's been really hard, I think, for us to push that counter narrative. And so that's something I think we really need to work on.
Andrew, any closing thoughts for our listeners? And tell us your website and social media, how we can follow the kind of how we can follow the work that you're doing.
Yeah, I would just say that this is something that we really need our community to stand up and demand, right? Demand change, demand that we move to a system that does not lock people in cages as a way of controlling the social order, right? And, you know, we think that we need to make this a cornerstone issue of a lot of different progressive movements. You can learn more about Unite Oregon at uniteoregon.org. We are a statewide organization with offices in Portland, Washington County, and Medford. And we represent about 13,000 members and supporters across the state, working to build an intercultural movement for immigrant and refugee justice, working primarily with immigrant and refugee communities, communities of color, and rural working class folks.
Andrew Riley, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Doug.
That was my interview with Andrew Riley from Unite Oregon. We were talking about the Oregon Legislature's 2019 regular legislative session, which just wrapped up. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you've been listening to Prison Pipeline. You can find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Many thanks to my guests, Alice Lindell, Director of Communications at the Oregon Justice Resource Center, and Andrew Riley, Communications and Policy Associate at Unite Oregon. And a heartfelt thanks to you, dear listener, for joining us. You make it all worth it. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
Some simple thing that I've done. I try so hard, so please don't let me be.